This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new book, Censoring Science, is largely about my guest, Dr. James Hansen, and the efforts to tone down or silence his warnings about climate change. For the past 25 years, Hansen has directed NASA's premier climate research center, the Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Hansen says the Bush administration has interfered with how scientists communicate to the public. Science has been swift-boated, is how Mark Bowen, the author of Censoring Science, puts it. Bowen is with us, too. Bowen's book reports on efforts during the Bush administration from political appointees within NASA to prevent Hansen from speaking to the press and to control statements by Hansen and other scientists about global warming and other scientific issues, including evolution. The book Censoring Science begins with a turning point, a speech Hansen made on December 6, 2005, before a meeting of the American Geophysical Union. I asked Hansen about that event. What did you say there that you think was, in a way, a tipping point to the Bush administration reaction to you?
Well, the science that I discussed was the fact that we are getting very close to a tipping point in the climate system where changes will begin to happen that are out of our control. But I think the thing that I said that perhaps caused concern was I pointed out that special interests are having a big impact on our ability to communicate this problem to the public and to find the solutions to it.
Now, what kind of warning did you receive after this speech?
Well, I was told that any future contacts with media would have to be approved by NASA headquarters, by public affairs officials, before I could speak. So if I received an email or telephone call, I had to say, I can't speak with you. You'll have to contact NASA headquarters and ask for permission to talk to me.
And you never had to do that before?
No.
Were you also told there would be dire consequences if you continued to make statements like you did at the American Geophysical Union meeting?
Well, that message was relayed to me by the public affairs official in New York City, yes.
Now, there were times when things were going on behind the scenes that I think at the time you weren't even aware of. And Mark Bowen, these are some of the things that you report on for the book Censoring Science. For example, James Hansen was invited to speak on an NPR program called On Point, hosted by Tom Ashbrook. Mark, if you could give us like a short description of what happened to that interview request.
Well, it first came in to Jim's public affairs officer in New York City, Leslie McCarthy, and she did what she was supposed to do, which was to tell everyone in the public affairs department at NASA that this request had come in. This was mostly a courtesy on her part. But then she began to get messages that the ninth floor, so-called, which is where all the kind of senior officials of NASA reside, didn't want Jim to be on NPR. He was then told that one of the reasons was that it was the most liberal media outlet in the country. And, you know, Jim didn't actually get that message directly. He didn't even know this was all going on, as you pointed out. And it was, for a while, prevented. He wasn't allowed to speak on NPR.
Or at least on that particular show.
Yes, until he finally just decided he was going to do it anyway, which was about 6 or 8 weeks later.
James Hansen, why did you decide you were going to do it anyway?
Well, over the holidays, I thought about this restriction, and I decided I really had to make it public. I spent the holiday with my family and my grandchildren, and I decided, you know, that for their sake and just for the sake of science, that I was going to make an issue out of this. And so I wrote down what had happened in great detail over several pages and made that available to the media.
So what was the reaction you got from NASA?
Well, this did then, because it came out in the public and it was reported in the New York Times, it became a major issue in NASA, and congressmen became involved and became concerned about the constraints on communication between scientists and the public, and NASA was told that it really needed to address this problem. So eventually the NASA administrator did come out with a strong statement that said scientists should be able to communicate with the public without interference by public affairs officials.
So did this make your ability to communicate with the public any more difficult or any easier when you went public?
It made it much easier in my case. However, as I pointed out in a talk shortly thereafter, this is not an isolated incident. This has become common practice, and all of the science agencies now seem to be headed by public affairs officials who are political appointees and who do attempt to influence the message that goes from the science agencies to the public.
Another example that you give of how people at NASA were edited by PR people was the case of Flint Wild, who was working on a NASA website about Einstein and referring to the Big Bang. What happened with that?
Well, there was this young political appointee who played a big role in Jim's life there for a while. He was the person who was kind of in the front line preventing the NPR interview from taking place. But earlier, he had taken an elective interest in cosmology, kind of without his boss's knowing particularly, and he had written this email to a fellow named Flint Wild who was working on a website about Albert Einstein, and I'll read the email here. It says, "Okay, Flint, we've got a slight problem here. These pieces refer to the Big Bang as if it were law. As you know, the theory that the universe was created by a Big Bang is just that, a theory. First of all, we have been given direction by our deputy AA, that is, assistant administrator, who would have been Dean Acosta, that we are never to refer to the Big Bang as anything but a theory. Secondly, it is not NASA's place, nor should it be, to make a declaration such as this about the existence of the universe that discounts intelligent design by a creator. We, as NASA, must be diligent here because this is more than a science issue. It is a religious issue. And I would hate to think that young people would only be getting one half of this debate from NASA."
Well, Mark Bowen, you write that the orders that were given from the top to people like George Deutsch, who were then expected to edit information, that these orders that came from the top were always given verbally so that there'd be no paper trail, no email trail.
Right. Actually, Jim corrected my thinking, a certain semantic thing. It's actually orally. It was always, they were always given by mouth. Mm-hmm. In person, in meetings in which there was usually only one witness at the lower level. It would be often two senior people in the presence of one career person who was directed in words to do something that this person usually had severe misgivings about. And this was very consciously done. It was a very intelligent thing. I mean, you cannot censor science in this country openly anymore, quite yet. And the people were fully aware of that. The reason that the story at NASA was harder to bring out was that they were so good at doing it. And what happened was George Deutsch, who was a young 24-year-old kid who was new here, didn't have any background in this sort of thing, made the mistake of leaving electronic, basically email records of this censorship practice.
Like the one you just read?
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guests are James Hansen, and he's the director of the NASA Institute for Space Studies. He's directed it for about 25 years, and he's been studying the human impact on Earth's climate since the 1970s. Also with us is Mark Bowen, who's written a new book about James Hansen and the censorship of science during the Bush administration. It's called Censoring Science. James Hansen, during the period that you felt you were being censored, you referred to the mission statement of your office, which included the phrase, to understand and protect our home planet. Then later you found out that that line of the mission statement was actually deleted in 2006. How did you find out, and what was behind the deletion?
Well, I began to refer to that statement shortly after my talk at AGU and the censorship issue came up, because I thought it provided a very strong basis for my speaking out that, in fact, it is my job. That is that was the first line in the NASA mission statement, to understand and protect our home planet. And I used that in my public talks for a couple of months. And then I was informed by another NASA employee that that line was then deleted from the NASA mission statement. And contrary to the construction of that statement, which was a very public construction in which all NASA employees were encouraged to comment on the proposed mission statement, this was deleted basically in the middle of the night. Nobody knew about it except the highest level at NASA headquarters. NASA is the largest science agency, spending more resources on studying the Earth than any other agency in the world. And it made a lot of sense that we would have such a mission statement. So it's quite a disappointment to see it disappear.
James Hansen, you've said that special interest groups have had too much influence on how the United States deals with climate change. You said, quote, "It seems to me that special interests have been a roadblock wielding undue influence over policymakers." Can you give us an example where you've seen that happen?
Well, that's a hard question to answer, because the way the special interests operate is to affect the media. The discussion of climate change that occurs in the public, they support the scientists that they can find, and you can always find some scientists who will disagree with a consensus view, and they make it appear that it's an even-handed issue, that some people think one thing and others think another, and so we're just not sure what's happening. But the science story has become very clear on global warming, that it is human-made and that it is growing, and it's going to cause very big problems in the future if we don't begin to change our emissions. And that basically means an impact on the fossil fuel industry. And they're tremendously powerful. They affect politicians at all levels in both parties. So it becomes now really a battle, I think, between special interests and the young people who will inherit the planet and the impact of the things that we're doing to it.
James Hansen, you've said, "I believe there is pressure on scientists to be conservative." You wrote this in July in an article in The New Scientist. What do you mean by that?
Well, scientists are naturally reticent, I think. Skepticism is an essential characteristic in science. You need to continually question yourself and your conclusions and your analysis. But in this particular, in the case of global warming, we've now reached a point where if we don't take action, we're going to pass tipping points that have large consequences in coming decades and create a situation in some cases, such as ice sheet instability, that will become out of our control. So I think we need to be a little clearer with the public about the way science operates and the degree to which we can understand what is happening and what is going to happen in the future. Otherwise, policymakers and the public just are not aware of the degree to which we do have a danger facing us.
And you feel that the information that global warming is really a threat to our planet is sufficient to start taking action?
Yeah, if you combine the information that we get from the history of the Earth, the paleoclimate data, which shows how the Earth has responded in the past to changes in atmospheric composition, combine that with the satellite data that shows how things are beginning to happen now in the Arctic, in the Antarctic, and combine this with global models, which are able to simulate quite well reasonably well what is happening, although many of the things are beginning to happen faster now in the real world than in the models. The sum of these things gives us a good picture that we do have a problem, and it is solvable, but we need to begin to take the actions to solve it.
James Hansen, what's an example of that?
Well, a good example is the Arctic sea ice, which this last summer decreased a large amount to its smallest...
20%, yeah.
Yeah, about 20%. But perhaps even more important is the ice sheets, Greenland and especially West Antarctica. We're beginning to see larger and larger areas with summer melt on these ice sheets, and the effect of that in speeding up the discharge of giant icebergs to the ocean has been quite remarkable. We still have time to avoid the disasters, in my opinion, but we're going to need to stabilize and reduce the rate of emission of especially carbon dioxide, but other greenhouse gases. And if we do that, we can stabilize the climate, but it requires actions in the near future to do that. So I think the most important thing that the public needs to do is put pressure on governments to have a moratorium on coal-fired power plants until we have the technology to capture and store the carbon dioxide.
Can I just interject here that what you said is probably exactly what makes the Bush administration most uncomfortable, that you, a scientist, are making policy recommendations that directly affect energy, coal. It would affect industry and business and so on. And I think they really want you to draw the line between just saying, this is the science.
Yeah, it's
and not crossing over and saying, this is what we should do, this is what policy should be, this is the changes we have to make. So can you just reflect on where you think the line should be, if any, you know?
Yeah, the question of the relation of science and policy is the fundamental issue. The problem is that the science inevitably has policy implications. And if we do not make clear the relation between our science and policy, it seems that no one will. And I think there's a strong analogy here to the case of NASA engineers who realize that there's a potential problem with the space shuttle, in the case of the O-rings on the space shuttle. I think when you realize there's a problem, it's your responsibility to make that problem clear to whatever levels it is necessary. And in this case, to the highest levels. And in fact, NASA engineers have been told that. They can go to the highest level if they find a problem that's going to threaten the lives of astronauts. They're allowed to go to the highest level with that information. And in this case, the highest level is the public. We need to make them aware of the implications of the actions that we're taking in emitting the greenhouse gases.
Have you ever felt that you were in danger of losing your job because of the way you've spoken out?
Yeah, I've assumed that that's a real possibility, but I would continue to do science anyhow, even if I lost the job. So it's not that big a concern of mine.
I want to thank you both for talking with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
Yeah, thanks.
Dr. James Hansen directs NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Mark Bowen is the author of the book, Censoring Science. We called NASA for their response to the charge that political appointees within NASA tried to alter the messages of scientists. We got this written response from NASA Administrator Michael Griffin. Quote, When these accusations were made 2 years ago, NASA put together a team of scientists, engineers, public affairs officers, and others from across the agency to examine our communications policies and procedures. That team revised and clarified those policies and procedures to ensure they clearly reflect the agency's commitment to free and open communications. The revised policy has been praised by the Government Accountability Office. The GAO report, issued in May 2007, said, GAO found that overall, NASA's policies, including its recently revised media policy, are clear and should help facilitate dissemination of scientific information. Unquote.